Hey everyone, and welcome back to Inside the Morgue. We're your hosts and amazing autopsy techs, Jess and Alice. So if you follow us on Instagram, you may have seen our story the other day, but we will be switching to a schedule of putting out episodes every other week. We've just had a bit of a busier schedule in our personal lives, and also with our work schedules too. And we just feel like we need...
We're both planning separate weddings
around the same time.
But also kind of together, because we're... we're in each other's bridal parties, but...
Our lives have just gotten just a bit busier.
But, like, a good busy. Like,
yeah.
We're doing fun, exciting things.
Yeah. So, but we still want to put, like, quality episodes out, so we just feel like we need more time to, like, prep and record and edit and everything for you. So that's why we're going to switch to every other week. But with that being said, for today's episode, we watched NCIS Season 3, Episode 21, titled Bloodbath. And this is a very Abby-centered episode, which we love. And there's a lot of stalking happening, so let's just get right into it.
Which we don't love.
We don't love that. Anti-stalking.
Okay, this podcast is very anti-stalking, as you'll hear at the end, for sure. So we open on a couple checking in to stay at a motel or a hotel. I don't know. What is the big difference between a motel and a hotel? Like, I feel like I can, if I look at them, I can tell the difference. But, like, what is the definition?
I don't know what the exact definition is, but I feel like motel is for, like, the lower end. Like, you're not staying as long and you're not expecting as much as a hotel provides. And it's really just, like, you need a place to sleep for the night. Whereas, like, a hotel, you're expecting that, like, hotel experience. I don't know. That's what I think in my head.
Yeah. Like, if I see something, like, in Schitt's Creek, like, what they live in.
That's what I think.
That's a motel. That's a motel for sure. Sorry. I wrote motel in the script, and I'm like, I think it was a hotel, but I can't put my finger on why. But anyway. Sorry to go on a rant, like, in the first sentence. So the woman is complaining that the last time they stayed at this place, she saw a cockroach. Her husband said there wasn't a cockroach and that he has been an entomologist for 32 years, so he would know a cockroach if he saw one. Based off of that line alone, I thought these people were going to be a lot more interesting in this episode than they were. I was like, oh, is he going to be, like, involved in solving a case because, like, he's going to be, like, a forensic entomologist? No. This is their part.
I thought he was going to have such a bigger role, and he had that line and maybe one other line, and that was it.
I thought, like, he was coming to help. Like, he's coming to stay near the naval base. So I was like, oh, is he coming to help NCIS with a crazy case, like, with bugs and stuff? Like, this is going to be so cool to talk about. No. He's just staying at this hotel.
Very anticlimactic. Yeah.
So the hotel worker that is helping them with their bags ensures them that the room is in tip-top shape. But as soon as they open the door, they find the room covered in blood and what appears to just be, like, human tissue strewn about the room. So, obviously, the NCIS team is called in because this hotel is an off-base lodging facility mostly used by TDY personnel and visiting family. The strange thing about this scene is that there's no body. The team gets there and is photographing the scene, which, you know, we love our photos. We'll give a green flag. Then there's a note on the ground saying red rum, and Danuzzo quickly makes the Shining joke, which I did love. Classic The Shining. But I think Ziva doesn't get it. Like, he makes a joke about a kid on a tricycle and, like, some creepy twins in the room, and Ziva's like, what are you talking about? And he's like, it's from The Shining. So they find out that the last occupants of the room left 2 days ago, and then the room was cleaned yesterday, and then it was locked up until the new guests arrived to the gruesome scene. There was no sign of forced entry, but a former guest may have kept a key to the room, so they're going to look through a list of anybody who had stayed in that room before. There's a field test that determines the blood was human, but they still don't know what, quote, parts are strewn everywhere. While searching the room, McGee finds a box of white powdered substance and suggests maybe this was a drug deal gone wrong. But Danuzzo points out, how bad would a drug deal have to be for the drugs to be left behind? So, like, yeah, if there's a drug deal gone wrong, somebody kills somebody else, they're not going to leave a suitcase of what appears to be cocaine behind. Ducky, our beloved pathologist, is on the scene and says that all the tissue scattered around the room is human fascia, or fibrous connective tissue that anchors skin to muscle. But there is neither skin nor muscle found at the scene, so it looks like it was skillfully dissected. Dougie thinks that at least three people were dissected in this room, and he thinks whoever did it is a trained medical practitioner. Back at the office, McGee can't find any doctors or surgeons who stayed at the hotel, but he did find that the maid had her master key stolen 2 days ago, so they know how the killer got in the room. Ziva ran the prints found in the room, and there was 15 sets in total, all of whom were registered guests, but only two were in the area last night, and they both had, quote, airtight alibis, which we never hear what they were. They're just airtight. DiNozzo analyzes the blood spatter in the room and notices that they are emanating from a central point. So this could be known as the point of origin, the estimation of where the victim and the suspect were in relation to each other when the bloodshed occurred. The TV is on the floor and shattered and looks like it was knocked off in some sort of struggle. But our lovely forensic scientist, Abby, found... I'm sorry, we can keep this in because this is hilarious. I meant to write shards. I wrote shards in the script. I didn't notice until reading it just now.
I didn't catch that until now.
I'm crying right now.
We are five-year-olds.
We're so mature. Ooh. I'm literally tearing up right now, guys. I'm so sorry. I'm so professional. Okay. Abby found shards. Oh, my God. Of CRT from the TV in a bath mat. Whew. So, I can't get it together. I'm sorry. Okay. So, DiNozzo thinks that whoever did this covered the TV with the bath mat to cover the sound of it breaking. So, he thinks this scene is staged based off of the spatter pattern. It looks like it was splashed on the wall. And he thinks the TV breaking was intentional. So, he thinks, like, somebody covered the TV with the mat and, like, punched it so they didn't, like, cut their hand or anything. And he, like, muffled the sound. Back in the morgue, Ducky and his assistant are trying to piece together the fascia to make somewhat of a human shape. And Ducky suggests starting at the corner pieces, like a puzzle. We love puzzles. And he tells his assistant to start with the plantar fasciae, or the feet, and to work his way up from there. Ducky says that the original term for jigsaw puzzle was actually dissected map, originating by Europeans in the late 1760s. Gibbs comes into the morgue, and Ducky tells him that they know there are at least four bodies in all the pieces. They were originally thinking that it was a serial killer, and, like, I loved this. The assistant seemed kind of excited in, like, a morbid way. He's like, yeah, we thought it was a serial killer, but it's not.
I would have been the same way, though.
I feel like everybody would be a little bit, like, you don't want it. Like, deep down, you don't want that to happen. But yeah. There's, like, a morbid part of us that are just curious. We've talked about morbid curiosity a ton on this podcast. Uh-huh. You all get it. If you're listening, you understand. But Ducky says that he notices traces of vascular tissue, which is exactly what you would find in a biomedical waste bin after surgery. So Ducky thinks that instead of somebody, like, dissecting a person in the hotel room, he thinks somebody took medical waste and threw it about the room to stage the scene. So he agrees with DiNozzo that the scene was staged, but he doesn't understand why. In the lab, Abby is running tests on the suspicious white powder that was found in the room. McGee comes in to check on her progress when suddenly Abby smells something off. McGee doesn't smell it, but Abby quickly realizes she smells the scent of almonds and says that they need to leave immediately because that's what cyanide gas smells like. And this is a green flag because this is true and only certain people can smell it. I forget the exact statistic and I definitely should have looked it up, but it's like a small part of the population. It's like a genetic thing that only certain people can smell it. And I believe it was the Tylenol cyanide killings. That's how they discovered that it was cyanide. There was somebody that was able to smell on one of the victims, like at autopsy or something. They were able to smell like, it smells nurses. Like bitter almonds. It was either that or the Excedrin. There was a copycat that tried to do it with Excedrin, but she was caught. The Tylenol cyanide killer in Chicago was never caught.
Was there something with Sherlock Holmes and almonds?
Probably.
Or am I making that up?
Probably. I don't know. I read Sherlock Holmes a while ago, and I've, like, watched the show Sherlock, of course, with Benedict Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm.
But
Yeah. Dom and I are rewatching that now.
Oh, really?
So that's what made me think. I was like, I wonder if that was ever a thing.
I feel like if anybody in the population could smell cyanide, it would be Sherlock. He'd have a nose for it.
I wonder if I could smell bitter almonds.
I literally, after watching this episode, Costa was eating trail mix that had almonds in it. And I took one and I was like, how would you describe an almond smell? And I'm like sniffing it. He's like, what are you doing to my trail mix? And I was
like, leave me alone.
I was like, I want to know if the scent of almond is that strong where I'd be like, yep, it smells like almonds. But like, I've had.
Or is it like a stronger aroma?
What I imagine it to be. Have you ever put like almond extract in baking goods?
Like, I have not.
It's common in, I think, like, you know, like the tri-colored rainbow cookies you can get at like Italian bakeries. They use almond extract in those. And so, and it has a very distinct smell, and it's like a little sweeter than like a typical almond smell. So that's how I always imagine it. But I've heard that it's the smell of cyanide smells like bitter almonds. Hopefully, I mean, if you taste it, I don't know if you'd be alive to tell the story, but
right.
I've heard it like smells bitter, almost like a bitter almond smell, but I couldn't think what that would smell like.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if I am able to smell it, but I'm just not able to identify it when I smell it.
Right. Now, like, oh, if we ever get a case at work and there's like cyanide poisoning on like the clothing or like in them or something, I'm like, oh my God, like, would I be able to smell it, or would I just die in the room?
I just wouldn't know.
Also, right. Can we talk about how McGee dragged Abby out of the lab?
Oh my God, yes, I forgot about that. They're like running hand in hand, and McGee just like is running faster, and Abby falls, and he just keeps dragging her on the floor. She's just like, okay, we're going.
She's like sliding on her butt as he's dragging her.
I forgot about that part. That was really funny. So they quickly exit the lab while McGee is dragging Abby, and they hit an emergency alarm, which also seals the room. And then we cut to a biomed team coming in to investigate the lab. They say another 3 minutes in there and Abby could have died. What they thought was cocaine was laced with potassium cyanide, and when mixed with the cobalt thiocyanate Abby was using for her test, it created a hydrogen cyanide gas. So potassium cyanide does release hydrogen cyanide gas, so I think this may be true, but if someone has more information, please let us know. Cobalt thiocyanate is what is used in a Scott test, which can be used to test for cocaine. So that is why Abby was using it, because the field test at the scene said it was cocaine, so she was just trying to get a more positive, like, verified scientific result. Abby and McGee go to get checked by Ducky, who, would you just go to, like, I know Ducky is a medical doctor, but he's a pathologist. Like, they have to have, like, they should have, like, more medical personnel on the base.
They should.
Other than just Ducky.
They should have, like, a first aid team or something.
Right? I know, like, they probably trust Ducky and they're more comfortable around him. But, like, why does he have...
I would go to Ducky.
I would go to Ducky, for sure. But why does he have a stethoscope? Like, he never needs that at work.
He's so cute.
Why does he just have that?
That's what I feel like... The one doctor that we work with that obviously he reminds us of Ducky all the time. I know exactly what you're talking about. That's what I think our doctor would do. Like, I would go to him for anything and, like, ask him, like, any medical question I have. And I feel like he is the, like, Ducky reincarnated.
Yeah. You're right. Like, I thought about giving this a potential red flag, but it's not really anything forensic related, so I can't speak to it. Also, I don't want a red flag Ducky. I love Ducky.
It's out of character for us.
Yeah. So, you know what? We're just going to say Ducky's allowed to do this. So, Ducky tells them that he doesn't anticipate any long-term ramifications from their brief gas exposure. While Abby and McGee are being treated for their exposure, Donoso took a look into Abby's past. Like, just on a whim. Well, not really on a whim. They think that Abby is being targeted. So, he found someone in Abby's past who might want to hurt her. The team goes to talk to her and says that they think the crime scene was set up to get Abby's attention and make an attempt to kill her with the cyanide gas. The man's name that they found is Michael Maurer, and he has called Abby 200 times in the last 4 months, and one of them was right before the accident in her lab. They also checked Abby's credit card bill and found that she bought Maurer a straight jacket for his birthday. She confesses that they dated last year and things got out of hand and she filed a restraining order against him. She says she was too embarrassed to tell them about Maurer earlier. They also found that Maurer has a website shrine dedicated to Abby called myhotdarkangel.com. Abby insists that while Maurer is creepy, he isn't the violent type, but DeNoza reveals that they found out he cleans up crime scenes for a living, which necessarily doesn't make somebody violent, but with everything else they have at their disposal, it is a little iffy because they found bits of human people at the scene, so they think he did it because he has access to that. So Abby doesn't think Maurer is their guy, but the team goes to pay him a visit anyway. And they arrive at Crime Cleanup, spelt with K in Crime and K in Cleanup, and they hear music playing. And if you're curious, it was American Witch by Rob Zombie. I love that song. I was like rocking out when they were walking in. I'm like, all right.
That's awesome.
They go to walk in, but see two bodies that look like they were shot in the head inside. So they all draw their weapons and enter very cautiously. And then DeNoza notices a camera set up on a timer, and suddenly one of the bodies just sits up and yells at them for ruining his photo. They were doing before and after photos for their new cleaning brochure. The team, very aggressively, confronts this guy about stalking Abby. But he says he's in therapy now and was calling to apologize to Abby for his obsessive behavior. You don't call 200 times to apologize for obsessive behavior.
Sounds a little obsessive.
He says he's on medication now, and he even has a new girlfriend. They show him photos of the crime scene, and he says he has nothing to do with it, and he even has an alibi. He was with DC Metro helping the crime scene cleanups for the past 2 days. After confirming the alibi with DC Metro, they head back to the office. Ziva is going to contact the local medical waste facilities and see if anyone reported a break-in, and DeNoza is going to run a background check on all of the hotel staff. He tells McGee to take Abby to his apartment for the night so Abby isn't alone, and even though Abby is sure she's going to be fine. She eventually agrees to stay the night at McGee's, and while they're getting ready for bed, she realizes she left her toothbrush in the car. McGee leaves to get it, and there is immediately a knock on his apartment door. Abby opens it, and it's just McGee, because he realized he forgot his car key. He leaves again and tells her not to open the door for anyone while he's gone. However, right after he leaves again, there's another knock, and Abby assumes it's just McGee again forgetting something else. So she opens it, but it's not McGee. It's her stalker, Michael Maurer. And can I just say one thing? We've talked about this before when we talk about NCIS, but can we talk about how there's so much sexual tension between everyone on this like Abby and McGee, Ziva and DeNoza. Like, I think Abby and McGee, I haven't watched this show from start to finish. I like catch it when it's on TV. But they were like alluding to the fact that they've dated and or hooked up before. Because she's like, oh, is my toothbrush still
and
here?
She was like in she her was straight underwear, up in underwear in his apartment.
It was an adorable set though. She had like a cute like skeleton tank top and like little like booty short underwear things. It was cute.
Me and my fiance Dom were watching it. And he was like, why is she in underwear? Like, would you ever be that comfortable with your colleague in their apartment? Not. I was like, never.
No. I wouldn't be. But you know what? Abby's Abby. And she was also like wearing one of his shirts. And she said it smelled like another woman's like perfume. And she wasn't like jealous. But she's like, ooh, you're dating someone new. This smells like perfume. And then she's like, oh, I forgot my toothbrush. And he's like, oh, I think your other one's still in the bathroom. And I'm like, you had a toothbrush at McGee's place?
Right. I was like, I missed a lot in this show.
And that's like more than like a hookup situation. You don't leave a toothbrush if it's a casual thing. Right? And she even said, she made a comment about sleeping in the same bed and how they were both adults and it was fine. And I'm just like, why is everybody so attracted to each other in this show? Everybody except Gibbs. Gibbs and Ducky are the only ones there to like do a job. Everybody else does their job right. And also flirts with everybody they come into contact with in the office. Sorry, I just had to get that out there.
It's like classic NCIS.
So anyway, her stalker, Michael Maurer, enters. Michael Maurer, not Michael
Maurer. Not Michael Maurer.
Listen, it's hard. It sounds like Michael. It's Michael Maurer or Maurer. Not Maurer.
So Michael forces his way in and says he forgot how beautiful Abby was. Abby tells him to go away, and he says that he's there to save her and protect her from what happened to her in the lab. She tries to ward him off as he approaches by throwing a typewriter at him, but misses. He keeps getting closer and Abby tries to run past him, but he grabs her. In the struggle, Abby's able to pick up a pair of handcuffs she has and she handcuffs him to a shelf. However, these are handcuffs that Michael had given her and he still has a key to these handcuffs around on his necklace, so he's able to unlock himself. Abby locks herself in McGee's room, but like, wouldn't you know it, our lovely Michael knows how to pick locks. As he's picking the lock, Abby hides in the bathroom, holding on to the lid of the back of the toilet as a weapon. And as a man enters the bathroom, she goes to hit him until she realizes that it's McGee with a gun raised. Abby gives him a hug and they both see that the bedroom door was open, so Michael must have climbed out when he heard that McGee came back into his apartment. So back at the office, DiNozzo comes back with photos after searching Michael Maurer's apartment, and he said that Michael must have skipped town and is nowhere to be found, but he did find a shrine to Abby in the apartment with a bunch of recent photos, so he has been keeping track of her for a while after she had a restraining order put against him. DiNozzo found out that Maurer's new, quote, girlfriend is a woman that he went on a date with, one date with. Not multiple dates.
One singular date.
That's not, doesn't make you girlfriend, boyfriend. And after talking to her, she said that he just talked about Abby the entire time. McGee finds that Maurer found a way to worm into Abby's computer to monitor her communications. And later, Gibbs finds out that Abby was being subpoenaed for a case she already testified on. He finds out that the defense got an anonymous tip that the prosecution's consultant was in protective custody. The defense wants to use this to discredit everything that Abby had testified to, claiming that if Abby dated someone whom she later had to get a restraining order against, shows bad judgment. Gibb thinks that the anonymous tipster was Michael Maurer, who knew about Abby's testimony from monitoring her computer activity. He called the tip to the defense to lure Abby out of hiding. Back at the office, the team is hard at work trying to locate Maurer. Gibbs makes the defense attorney, who's trying to depose Abby, come into the office, and he accuses her of harassing Abby, and she replies that it isn't harassment because she has a subpoena. Gibbs replies by saying he has a subpoena of his own, one requesting the email from the anonymous tipster who told the defense attorney that Abby was in protective custody. The team's hoping that they will be able to find and trace the routing information in the header on the email. The defense attorney argues that they can't go after the whistleblower and wants to speak to Abby, but Gibbs won't let her until she turns over the email, which she eventually does. McGee is able to narrow down the DNS server, but he is unable to get a trace quickly. The person used a public IP address to send the email. And after her deposition with the DA, Abby sets up a camp in her lab. She has a collection of tools from different members of the team to help her feel safe. Like, she has a taser, pepper spray, a safety whistle from Ducky. And the team is eventually able to trace down where the email was sent from. And it was sent from inside their building.
It's giving when a stranger calls. Like, the call's coming from inside the house. Yeah, that's immediately what I thought.
Or scream when he's calling. And
yes.
And Courtney Cox hangs up and then calls again. And it's like, gotcha.
Yeah. She's like, can I call you back? That's in Scream 6. I love that part.
It's my favorite part.
The whole like phone bit in Scream, which is a huge part of Scream, I believe is actually supposed to be like a reference to When a Stranger Calls. Because like all of Scream is a reference to other horror movies. So I believe like that's where they got the idea is like,
that's awesome.
When a stranger calls. Yeah.
So they go to find Abby and immediately call security. In her little makeshift bed in her lab, she gets a phone call. She thinks it's from one of the NCIS team members and like to check on her, but it's actually Michael. He says they got off on the wrong foot and that he needs a chance to talk to her. And he also says she isn't safe. And as she thinks she is, we can see him appear in the window outside of her lab. He says he wants to protect her from whoever tried to kill her in her own lab. He says he always used to protect her, like when someone stole her mail and when someone slashed her tires. And Abby reminds him that that was very much him who did all of those things to her. And Michael says that doesn't matter because what matters is it made her realize her true feelings for him. Wow, he's just like manipulating her.
the true feelings were repulsion.
Right?
True feelings were me getting a restraining order.
Abby's on her computer in the lab trying to locate where she's receiving the call from, and Michael sees her doing this and tells her to try a different way of looking it up, which is when Abby realizes that he's right inside the lab, right outside the lab and is watching her. She turns around and sees him, and he's looking in just as the rest of the team arrives, very armed, and they tell Abby to get down. She points to the window where she saw Michael. They head over, but he's gone now.
This guy has to be, like, the fastest man.
Oh, my God, I know. Give him an award.
He's always gone in, like, a split second. Like, as soon as somebody's there to save Abby, he's, like, nowhere to be found. Like, how fast is this man?
Ziva goes to lock down the parameters of NCIS headquarters so that no one can get in or out. And Abby is distraught because now she doesn't even feel safe in her old lab. Then she doesn't want to stay there anymore. She goes to stay the night with Gibbs, and she isn't able to sleep. Gibbs finds her in the basement, very drunk and upset, and she says that she thinks this is all her fault. And using some clever reverse psychology, he helps her realize that it's not her fault, that this, quote, defective lunatic is stalking her. He also says that he came down there to tell her that the Coast Guard got Michael and they have him in custody. We then cut to Abby at the office, looking in the interrogation room where Michael is pacing around, ranting about how he's being harassed. She tells the director of NCIS that Michael will probably find a loophole like he always does and find her again, but the director tells her that Gibbs won't let that happen. Abby is called to her deposition and has to leave, leaving Gibbs and DiNozzo there interrogating Michael. He keeps saying that he isn't the one who's trying to hurt Abby this time, and he only started following her again when they came to interrogating him at this office. He said their visit made him go through all of his old, quote, stalking photos, and he says he saw someone else that was following her. Another man is in the background of all of the photos that he took of Abby from a distance. He says that he thinks that this man is the one trying to get Abby killed. They look through his photos and they see a man that he's talking about, and sure enough, he is in every single one of the photos. Michael says the only reason that he was able to successfully tap into Abby's computer is because somebody else had already cracked the authentication before he did. We cut to Abby getting into a government car to be taken to her deposition, and we see the driver of the car is the same man from these photos. DiNozzo and Gibbs call McGee, and McGee confirms that someone else had cracked the authentication calls on Abby's computer before Michael hacked into it. Just then, the director gets a call from the federal marshal that was supposed to pick up Abby, and that someone slashed their tires on the transport, and he hasn't even left yet to pick her up. DiNozzo and Gibbs run out of the room. We see Abby in the car with a man, and she's getting a call on her cell phone from the office. She goes to answer it, but the man grabs it, so she's not able to. At the office, they try to track her phone while Gibbs and DiNozzo head out to try to find her, and McGee is able to get a GPS location on Abby's phone and send it to them. They follow it and find Abby's phone in the street. They hear the sound of her whistle that Ducky had given her as well, a screaming, and they follow the sounds to the van that Abby was picked up in. And when they open the door, they find that the man is the one screaming and Abby is tasing him. She ends up still having to go to court, and she's very upset because her testimony was ruled inadmissible. They see the defense attorney and a smug defendant who's excited that he got off on all his charges. The NCIS team tells him not to get too smug because they found out that he was the one who hired the hitman on Abby since she was the star witness in his case, and he's arrested. Back at NCIS, Gibbs goes back to the interrogation room to talk to Michael. Michael says he knew he was right and that he really cared about Abby, but Gibbs tells him that he's still being charged because they found a gun that he had and a suicide note that he had forged in Abby's name. Michael tries to say that would have just been a last resort and that Abby really loves him but just won't admit it. And we are left with Gibbs leaving that room, and Michael is calling out to Abby, who is not there.
Ending on that note, that, like, so once I realized it wasn't Michael that was trying to kill her, I was like, okay, they're going to have to do something where they don't make Michael the hero, because they can't make the actual stalker the hero of the story. But the chill that I got when Gibbs is like, we found the gun in your car and the suicide note that you forged in Abby's handwriting. Like, that, insane. Like, that, I was like, oh my God, that is dark. So dark.
Like, the lengths that you would go to for that.
It's scary. Like,
I can't even fathom it.
And we're going to get into it, but that's some people's reality. Like, that's horrifying.
But I thought this was a cool plot twist that, like, the who she was, the, all, like, her testimony against that guy turned out to be the hitman. Like, he hired the hitman and everything, and I wasn't expecting that.
Yeah, because they kind of, like, lightly sprinkled it throughout the episode. Like, Abby was trying on different outfits for court, but, like, it was, like, seemed like a subplot, and then you realize, oh my God, it's, like, she's the star witness, and this guy's trying to take her out.
Crazy.
Yeah, and it was like an embezzlement case or something, and it was the scent evidence or something that she had, and they ruled that like scent evidence wasn't a hard enough, it wasn't a peer-reviewed scientific method, so that's why it was ruled inadmissible. It wasn't because she was being stalked, because I thought that was messed up too when they hinted that like her testimony was being ruled inadmissible because she had a stalker. I was like, that's messed up. And then the defense attorney is like, that's not why I did it. Like, it's because this, like, method hasn't been peer reviewed or journaled or anything. And I'm like, all right, it makes a little more sense. But still, what the hell? Like,
cut her some slack.
Yeah. She's being stalked. And has a hitman after her. Like, I like the stress that Abby is under. Please. Leave this woman alone.
And the stress of testifying.
For real. And she didn't, like, she was trying on different outfits. She didn't want to, and she was stressed the whole time. Poor Abby. Okay, so this episode obviously had the theme of Abby dealing with this stalker. And we found a story that actually involves the actress who plays Abby, Pauly Perrette, and her experience with a stalker and how she's been very vocal about having stricter stalking laws. So in a segment with 48 Hours and also in an interview with CBS, Pauly Perrette got candid about her experience. Her stalker had never implicitly threatened her life, but she always feared the harassment would escalate. So she told in this interview that she lives in fear every day, just like every other victim of stalking. And Perrette didn't want to give her stalker the attention that he craves, so she refrained from going into detail. But she did say that he came close to destroying her. She said, quote, I had been harassed and terrorized for so long. I was completely suicidal. I was just like, I can't live like this. I can't, end quote. She also added that law enforcement was slow to act when she did seek help. She said, quote, I was told by a police officer once, that I should have just stayed and let the stalker break my arms so that they would have something to prosecute. And I went, I don't want my arms broken, end quote. Perrette said that the first victimization is being stalked and terrorized and harassed, and that the second victimization is that the system doesn't work for stalking victims. According to the Center for Disease Control, 1 in 6 women and 1 in 19 men have experienced stalking to the point that they felt fearful or believed someone close to them could be harmed or killed. That is an insane statistic that, like, 1 in 6 women.
I didn't know it was that high.
Yeah, and 1 in 19 men is pretty high too, but 1 in 6 women. And like, not just being stalked, but being stalked to the point where you feel fearful for your life or the lives of those that you care about. Like, that's so scary. So Perrette went on to say that she thinks it's time to do something and it was time to speak out. She said, I'm so scared sitting here talking about it. It puts the same fear into every victim. But we can't keep this a secret. We have to be courageous. We have to get these laws changed. I'm here for the victims. I'm here for the next victim. End quote. In the wake of the tragic murder of Christina Grimmie at the hands of an internet stalker in 2016, Perrette pushed to speak out about having stalking laws changed. She said, stalking laws do not work right now. They have not been updated in 20 years. In that 20 years, so much has happened, mainly the internet. Stalkers, that's their greatest tool. They can use the internet to stalk their victims. So creating stricter stalking laws would, sorry, like advocates want, could conflict with personal freedoms, but Perrette says that victims' rights to freedoms should be considered too. She says that everyone is looking for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but stalking victims don't get that. They live in fear every day, and it affects their everyday life. And I also just want to say, in case you're not familiar with the Christina Grimmie, like, tragic case, there was a stalker she had on the internet that she wasn't even aware of, and I believe it was a show in Orlando, and she tweeted that she was doing a show with her band in Orlando and to come see her. And this guy just showed up with a gun and waited in line to, like, meet her, do, like, a meet and greet. And when he got to the front of the line, he just started shooting. And it's just so sad. And, like, somebody tackled him, but I think he shot himself, so he was never arrested. I don't know his name. I don't care about his name. But it's just insane. Like, she wasn't even aware of it because of the internet. Like, he was doing it all over the internet. She, like, he wasn't actually, I mean, to my knowledge, following her. He might have been. But, yeah, it's so scary.
Yeah.
And we got this information from a CBS article from 2017 by Aaron Moriarty, and we will link that in our show notes if you want to read more. They also had, I didn't want to just copy and paste the article in here, but it was Pauly Perrette and I think three other victims of stalking that have all kind of come together and are speaking out about their experiences and how they've kind of supported each other throughout this horrible thing that's happening to all of them. And it was really just very well written. These women are incredible. I highly recommend reading the full article. I just didn't want to rip off the whole article here, but they talk about how they found, like, support in each other and how they're trying to be a voice for other victims. And it's just a really, I think people should read it. It's good to know. And we will also be including a Victim Connect link in our show notes if you or someone you know may be the victim of stalking and need some resources.
That's, like, heavy material.
I don't know the timeline of everything, so I don't know if this, if Pauly Perrette's own experience was loosely based on the episode or not, or if it was something that happened after, but yeah, it's scary.
I think that she's totally right, though. Like, there have been so many updates in, like, not even last 20 years, like, the last 5 years in the internet and, like, AI and all of these new things coming out. Like,
AI laws need to be,
it does, laws need to be updated almost regularly to keep up with all this new technology that's coming out, to, like, properly keep everybody safe.
Yeah, it really, the two things she, I mean, a lot of what she said really shook me, but one thing she said was the police officer told her she should have stayed and gotten assaulted because then they could have
prosecuted
them.
Don't victim blame.
And she's like, I'm sorry, I don't want my arms broken. And
you are supposed to serve and protect me, sir. Don't tell me I should have been hurt in order for you to do something about my issue.
She's so right. Like, that's, like, she's so right in saying that the system doesn't work for stalking victims because the police, they're like, there's no law that, like, says I can do anything right now. You, like, I can only do anything if he hurts you. And it's like,
this system is so broken everywhere.
I will say this article is from 2017. I haven't read, like, the most recent stalking laws, but as from what I've seen, there definitely is room for improvement. And the other thing she said that really struck me was, so people are concerned that with stricter stalking laws, it would conflict with, like, personal freedoms, like constitutional rights and stuff. And she's like, yeah, everybody wants life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, but I don't get that. I don't get liberty. I'm scared going outside. Like,
right.
That's so true. Like, she deserves life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness just as much as everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
I was getting heated reading this. Like, I was.
Now my blood is boiling.
I know. I'm sorry. But yeah, if you guys know anything about, like, updating stalking laws, or if you have any resources you want us to share on our social media, please let us know.
Mm-hmm.
I just found the Victim Connect link. They had just a page about, like, things to do if you're, I feel weird saying this, things to do if you're being stalked, because it's putting it all on the victim, but like things you can do if you think you're being stalked. What are the signs that someone is stalking you? And they also had like some other website links and like resources and phone numbers you can call. And obviously if you're in immediate danger, call 911. But if there's other less urgent emergencies, or not emergencies, but like less urgent situations that you need just like help with, they had other resources on there. So we'll put that in the show notes.
Yeah, I hope that everybody does stay safe out there, no matter what your situation is. But to end this episode, we tallied a total of 2 green flags and 0 red flags. So in our opinion, this episode of NCIS does pass in terms of forensic accuracy. Thanks for listening to Inside the Morgue. If you want to learn more about forensics and true crime, keep on listening. You can follow us on Instagram to stay up to date with everything that we do. And we'll be back next time with a brand new dissection.